Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 20th of August. Very nice to have you with us. And rainy day, but that's okay. I don't know where you are, and hopefully it will be it'll be lovely and sunshiny. And if it isn't, maybe it's that way in your heart. Or not. Good morning, all. Welcome. We welcome you to the program. We welcome you to join us and to be a part of this conversation that we're going to have. We're going to talk a lot about the Democratic National Convention that took place. Day one took place yesterday and last evening was the prime time events. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Let me introduce our group this morning, and we'll get started and start trying to make sense of it all. Former New York 19 Congressman John Faso is here. Good morning, John. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. I'm not going to let you rain on my parade, though, because I'm hoping the forecast is sunnier than what you're let on earlier.
Yes. Well, I hope so. I would. My goodness, I would hope so.
This weekend is supposed to be nice, though.
Yeah, cool and clear,
dry,
and we'll take it. Yes,
yep.
We had a very rainy night at the Washington County Fair last night. My wife and I went.
Oh, dear.
And we said, do we care that it's raining? We said, no. We love this event so much, we're going to go even in the rain.
Really?
And then about halfway down from the horse barn to the milking parlor, we said, this was a bad idea. Fred Hoff joins us, former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat who taught at Bard College for 6 years, now a senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Ambassador Hoff. How
hey,
are you?
Good morning, Joe. Delighted to be here.
Always wonderful to have you on the program. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is here, back from a sojourn. Where were you?
I've been traveling, chasing grandchildren in Oregon and Colorado, you know.
Oh, that's nice. That, yeah. What a
lovely, a lot of fun.
Yeah,
a lot of fun.
A
great,
trip.
Great places to visit, too, especially in the summer, hiking and, you know, beautiful weather, everything. So it was all good.
So
glad to be back.
Here's the big question.
Yeah.
How tired are you?
I am tired.
That's what I would have thought that.
Yeah.
But,
but happy. But happy.
Judy Patrick is getting ready for the grandchildren to descend on. They come to her. So that's good.
That's right. I have a week-long grandma camp, we call it. And the number one rule of grandma camp is ice cream every day. I bought a box of Frosted Flakes yesterday. They don't get to eat that stuff when they're at home.
Oh, that's so great. That's yeah. Right. Well, it's nice of you to sugar them up and keep them. Usually you sugar them up and then send them back. That's good.
Hey, and I say let it rain. I planted my fall spinach and my fall lettuce, and I want some germination to happen. So rain all day if you want.
That's great. Well, we'll help your garden. Judy, that's what we aim to do. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it. Again, you can be a part of the program, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's talk about what happened last night, and that is, of course, the opening night of the Democratic National Convention. The Chicago group got together in the afternoon. There were protests. We'll talk about that in a moment. I do want to start with the primetime events, the speeches that took place. Of course, the ultimate speech was at the end was Joe Biden, President Joe Biden speaking. The entire, I would say, theme of the night was go, Joe, and thank you very much for your incredible service.
Go, Joe.
Go. Go, Joe, and go. Just go. But they had a lovely, many nice words said of the current president, and then I thought it would start around 10:30, and then somewhere around midnight, the speech started, and it was a long one. It went, Mike was just telling me, 43 minutes without applause?
Without, and then when you add in the intro and all the applause and the flag waving and all that, it was, what was it, John?
53
minutes.
10 minutes. Yeah, so, and then we had speeches by Hillary Clinton spoke last night. Jamie Raskin spoke last night. Kathy Hochul spoke last night.
Earlier.
Very early. Yes. I believe the first primetime speaker. In fact, to the point where people had not even started to shut up yet. There was still a lot of noise in the room. But she spoke, and there were, again, unity. They were trying to show that. AOC spoke last night. They made brief mentions of Gaza, nothing specific, nothing in depth. A lot about kitchen table issues, a lot spoken in both the speeches and in video pieces in regards to women's health care. And so really setting the table for the week that is to come. So let me just go around the room and get introductory thoughts on last night's 2024 Democratic National Convention from Chicago, Illinois. Judy.
So my plea to the Democratic Party is to have the A-list speakers talk earlier in the night. I mean, I listen to way too many lieutenant governors, B-list speakers. I want to listen to... I caught Hillary Clinton. I almost thought that they intentionally pushed President Biden into the overnight hours so nobody could hear him. I mean, I'm sure that they didn't, but it seemed that way. Who stayed up that late to listen to him? They have a lot of energy going with the Kamala Harris campaign. They need to not weigh it down with boring convention speeches that eat up the from 6 to 10 o'clock hour. Put other people on. I understand that they want to give their up-and-coming stars a little bit of sunshine or a little bit of exposure, but at the end of the day, what's a convention for? I thought Hillary Clinton gave a great speech. It was wonderful. AOC's speech was great. Joe Biden, trying to be generous here, I mean, I wish he had focused more on Kamala Harris and his what she would do for the country going forward. I think he was due the applause and appreciation that he received. It's, you know, I'm surprised it went so late, and I hope that some editors get involved and cut some of these speeches that we're going to hear tonight short. They even did not have James Taylor sing. I mean, there's a lot of talk about whether Beyonce is going to appear on Thursday. I just hope that if they have Beyonce, they don't shove her off as well because lieutenant governors are talking so long.
Now, this is nothing against James Taylor, who I adore and I have seen in concert probably, and I'm not even exaggerating, probably 50 times. But I'm guessing it's easier to cut James Taylor than it is Beyonce.
We shall see.
I'm just thinking in negotiations. But yeah, and I was bummed because they kept on saying it was coming up, and I thought, oh, this is great. JT's going to be on, and then no. And you know, the other thing I was thinking of, John, was you think about when the Oscars go like 15 minutes over, you're like, come on, why can't you get it all in? And this one just, I mean, this was supposed to be, I think, over at 11:30, and it just went on till well after 12:30.
Well, I had a good excuse because we had a power outage with the storm.
Pretty merciful.
In Kinderhook, it didn't last.
The conservative gods were shining upon you,
they were shining down.
They?
But, you know, I wasn't going to stay up and watch Joe Biden, certainly not at 11:30 start. But, you know, in just to equal time here, I watched about 15 minutes of Donald Trump's acceptance speech and turned it off as well. And I'm glad when I heard it lasted 90 minutes that I didn't have to endure that. But, you know, Joe Biden made his speech last night. It's kind of like he took a trip down memory lane, 50 years in politics. But really what his party was doing is putting him down the memory hole to try to get rid of him as quick as possible. But in fairness to the Democrats, and I just looked this up as we started the show today, I was wondering, well, the last time this happens in a handoff from a president to a vice president was 88, Ronald Reagan to George H.W. Bush. And Ronald Reagan spoke on the first night. And the idea I think the Democrats had, get President Biden in there. He had to make his valedictory speech, and then you move him off the stage. And that's really what the Republicans did in 1988 with Ronald Reagan. You didn't want Ronald Reagan overshadowing the nominee.
Right.
I don't think there was any risk of Joe Biden overshadowing Kamala Harris, but I think they made the strategic decision. You get the president on the first night. Why they waited till 11:30 shows bad stage management on their part, because frankly, most viewers weren't watching it at 11:30.
Well, you know, and I know this may be a cheap shot, but remember when he was thinking about he was saying he was going to stay in the race,
right.
but obviously there was great pressure on for him to leave, and then he said, well, the problem is I'm too exhausted, so I'm going to stop events after 8. And then at 11:30, he was so past his bedtime. I mean, that is not helpful.
I mean, there's a lot we can say about it, but I do think that he deserved to have a valedictory. They gave him that. It was a little too late, obviously. But conventions are to try to put your best foot forward, and that's, I'm sure, what the Dems will be doing over the next 3 nights.
I will say I thought in both both the Republican and the and the Democratic. I mean, content is one thing, but the production and the stories that are told, I think, are just really good. And those narratives that they were telling last night, especially, I thought were quite poignant. Mike Spain.
Yeah, I agree with Judy about the Biden speech. It sounded almost like the speech being prepared for his acceptance if he was still in the race. And then he threw a few bouquets at Kamala Harris. Rather than trying to convince people that Kamala Harris is the best candidate, it didn't come across that way. But, you know, it was on so late, as you point out, that it really didn't matter. And you know, a lot of people are just getting clips of it on TikTok or YouTube or on the morning news or whatever it is. It's not like people sit, like political junkies that we are, sit and watch these things. But a lot of Trump bashing, as you would expect. I was a little, you know, kind of winced when Hillary was up and they were all shouting, lock him up, lock him up, lock him up. I mean, you know, that kind of rhetoric, I guess, fuels, you know, the audience and gets them going, but it just... Maybe they need to get that out of the way. I hope that they're doing all the bashing. The surrogates are doing the bashing of Trump so that Kamala Harris can maybe be above that and not go so low. I don't want to see 4 nights of just Trump bashing, because that's counterproductive. If she is going to succeed as a candidate, she has to show who she is. She has to define herself with specifics, and she has to look forward, not look back. And maybe that's why they're getting the bashing out earlier and trying to look forward afterwards, hopefully.
Fred Huff.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. The president's speech was a recitation of his accomplishments. And as David Brooks of The New York Times has put it, the Biden speech is a reminder to all of us of why he wouldn't have been able to win this election. So I think, I think having it, having it late at night may be for the Democrats a blessing and not necessarily a blessing in disguise. As I listened to these speakers go on and on and on, the one thought occurred to me, the greatest speech ever given by a political leader in the United States, Gettysburg Address, delivered by Abraham Lincoln. I looked it up this morning. It took President Lincoln all of 2 minutes, 2 minutes to deliver the Gettysburg Address. And John, I'm sure this is something you took to heart in your political career. Keep it short, keep it direct. But this is something that I think, our politicians could concentrate more on. I mean, brevity tends to concentrate the mind. And I think it would be good if our political leaders took that to heart. One of the early speakers who made a positive impression on me was Steve Kerr, yeah. Coach of the Golden State Warriors. Good speaker, good sense of humor.
Mm. Very funny.
Something that's that's at least for me very
and
welcome.
And an interesting family history.
Tremendously yes. interesting. His dad, Malcolm Kerr, was a hero of mine. A very, very eminent scholar of the Middle East, president of American University Beirut, who was assassinated in 1983 by Hezbollah when his son Steve was 18 years old. So that for me was a highlight. David Axelrod reminds us that 65% of Americans think the country is moving in the wrong direction. Okay. David Axelrod is not exactly a friend of Donald Trump's. So I think the bottom line here is give President Biden a chance to say goodbye, give him one more chance to recite what he considers his accomplishments to be, and move on to the main event.
Yes. In fairness, I would say David Axelrod, I don't think, is a big Biden friend either. But I understand the point.
His recitation of the percentage is correct.
Absolutely.
He's a smart guy, and he's a shrewd analyst of
very much
politics.
So.
Very much.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, and we welcome you to share your thoughts. We'll go to the letters when we come back. We'll continue our discussion about the events last night. We'll do all of that after this break and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Judy Patrick, John Faso, Mike Spain, and Ambassador Fred Hoff, we welcome you, panel@wamc.org. Okay, so we have a lot of letters, and on one topic, I mean, there's other topics as well, but so far, most people are writing to us about time zones. Pointing out that, yes, it was late for us, but not if you were in California. See,
right.
That's how time zones work. So if it was 11:30 here, it was 8:30 there. And so that's not late at all. And so they're telling us, they're teaching us about time zones and telling us to get a grip.
You know, out west, I was just on the West Coast. Out West, people get used to seeing football games in fall season at 5:30 and 6:30 at night. I mean, they've already adjusted to it, and their TV watching is earlier, and they probably turned it off also.
Well, I do think that we do have, the Academy Awards, the Grammys. Even the Super Bowl. All of these events take place at night at a time that is around 7, 8, 9 o'clock to facilitate an East Coast crowd. And yes, the West Coast then
sees it early.
Sees it
They're
early.
Used to it.
Sees it earlier
yeah.
than. Yeah,
they were expecting it early and it wasn't there.
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah, that was going to be dining viewing, and then it turned out not to be.
Yeah.
So, but we understand the point. We certainly.
Well, and Chicago is what an hour
just
different
an hour
different from us. What I'd be curious about is what was the President of the United States told in terms of when he should expect to come out on the stage and speak. I mean, sure, he's now a lame duck president, but he's not exactly chopped liver. And if he was given a certain time, that should have been adhered to.
Yeah, don't you think it would have been during that 10 to 11 time slot that, I mean, I know that all the cable channels had continual coverage all evening, but like NBC, ABC, CBS cut from regular programming over at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
And that's probably the window where he would be introduced and praised and get his speech going, at least, you know, because people are used to watching the 11 o'clock news and 10 o'clock news and that kind of thing.
Somebody can fact check me on this, but I believe Donald Trump started at the RNC around 10:30. So,
and that would have been optimum, I think.
Yeah. What they were expecting, and got, I mean, as John indicated, that went a lot longer than anyone expected it to. But again,
probably not longer than expected, but longer.
93 minutes.
Yeah. All right. It was the longest ever. But then we get this from Patricia, who said, "I thought most of the speakers were inspiring, spot on, and funny. I'm usually early to bed, and I ended up watching the entire night. AOC, Hillary, Clyburn, Jamie Raskin, the young people who spoke to the need for abortion rights." That was very moving, I thought. And yes, Joe Biden, all left me feeling proud to be a Democrat and eager to be voting for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. That from Patricia. Then we go to Karen. "Abraham Lincoln was not trying to rouse a crowd. Most of the speeches last night were short. Some of the speeches were quite good. AOC, Biden's daughter, for example." Was Biden's?
I thought it was his granddaughter who introduced him.
Yeah. Maybe it was. Okay. Chelsea, I don't think, spoke. But I have to check. Because I was asleep. Oh. Biden went on to on rather too long, but there were emotional moments. Generally, the evening worked for me as a Democratic pep rally. That from Karen. John says, "Lock him up was an irresistible chant when Hillary was speaking. There was no reason to lock her up, but plenty of reason to lock him up."
I thought Hillary handled that well. She didn't, you know, she resisted really responding to it, but she had a slight smile on her face. I mean, after all they put her through all those years ago, I think, you know, it was a little bit of redemption on her part. I mean, she took the high ground and didn't, you know, encourage them. She let it happen. And I thought it was a nice moment, to be honest.
Zachary says, "I was so excited for last night. I am a political junkie, just like you people, and I had to go to bed by 9. I'm only 33, but I have to work in the morning. They should have had him out of there about 8 by the latest. Thank God I didn't wait up all night to hear him bid us a final farewell. But I am very excited for Beyonce." So we don't know that Beyonce is actually performing. That's just a rumor that is out there. But we'll see what actually happens.
How about Taylor Swift? Any good rumors there?
Did you see there was a story yesterday that someone had put together and using AI, Taylor Swift dressed in a an American flag with Trump, you know, for president sign chanting, and then everybody in the audience wearing Trump tank tops and stuff like that. And Trump sent it out and says, "Accepted."
Yeah. And not true. All not true.
AI. All not true.
AI and forwarded by the former president.
I think she's in England, by the way.
Yeah. And she 4 years ago, I mean, really, really bitterly trashed Trump and endorsed Biden. So, I mean, it's very unlikely she switched.
You said she's in England, but I will say that she got back from Japan Super Bowl to see her boyfriend play. So if it's on her mind, she'll get here.
Yeah, well, I think she has a good flight pattern to go on. Yeah,
for her.
I think she's okay in that regard. Let's see. Claude says, "We watched the convention mainly to hear President Biden. Placing him at the end was a stroke of genius, actually. We would have gone to bed after his speech if it had been much earlier and missed many of the inspiring speakers if it had been at prime time." All right. Sean Fain is an American hero. I'm surprised no one is talking about his speech.
I think the strong union support came across very, very well. And he was,
UAW head spoke.
Several union people spoke, but he was obviously the top guy.
And made that reference several times that both Kamala and Joe Biden both were on the picket line with them, and that was historic and something that should not be forgotten by their members.
I'm sure he didn't mention his UAW support for Hamas, which would have been inconvenient to bring up at that time.
I'm checking. Yeah, you're right. He didn't bring that up. Kathy says, let's not be East Coast centric for most of the country. It wasn't so late. And I watched last night fascinated by the strength of President Biden's speech. No holds barred. He's in the middle of an extremely sensitive negotiation to prevent further war, and we must support his strength in foreign policy. The world is watching, and Trump is trying to tear down the United States. We must work to get hostages home. Joe is still president, and I am grateful for him. That in regards to the speech last night.
It is worth noting that Israel was able to bring home six dead hostages yesterday as well,
right,
in an action which is the Israelis are very close-lipped about this. They're not really saying much about it, but apparently they recovered them in a tunnel in the Khan Yunis area. But it's another reminder of what is going on in that part of the world and how serious that situation is.
We're getting reminders on pronunciation of Kamala Harris. It is Kamala. Mamala. Kamala. Just reminding everyone. That'll save us about 20 letters. Donna says, I agree that the lock her up remarks and refrain were not helpful. Do note that Hillary pretty much ignored it, though. Good call, Hillary. I would say the same thing about Kamala Harris has been doing that on the stump speech as well, ignoring it. As someone who lived through those early breakthroughs for women, I was moved when she mentioned Shirley Chisholm and Geraldine Ferraro, and they're paving the way, as she had, for the next generation. I am hopeful. Then we go to Rick. I just want to vent once again. The media, you guys, are so missing the big picture. Your focus on timing is absurd. Joe Biden was done by 10:30 local time, with all the tragic implications of Donald Trump possibly winning. Is this all you can focus on? You can do a lot better, folks. This is a non-story created to divert people from the amazing speeches that took place last night. Warnock, Clinton, Biden, so many. I, like many of the people in the audience, was in tears. Where is your heart?
All right. Well, I'll tell you why we focus on the timing of it is because the largest audience is earlier in the evening. And if you hold your best speaker until after midnight or close to midnight, you're losing audience. So if you want to get the Joe Biden message across, you put him on at a time when more people are listening and watching. I'll be anxious to see the viewership charts today about when things were the highest and when they were low. Now, in the day of social media, again, we'll see these clips today circulated, but you won't, and you can see the whole speech if you go on YouTube or any of the other social media platforms. But the reason we focus on speech and the timing is because unless you want to alienate the audience, you have to be short. You have to be respect their time. The average person is not going to sit through 5, 6, 7 hours of speeches.
You know, I do have to say, though, I did feel I was grumbling last night, and I felt guilty grumbling because it's if the Phillies were playing the Dodgers as they were 2 weeks ago on the West Coast, the game starts at 10:10. Well, I stayed up till 1:30 to watch that game.
But that's a ball game.
Yeah, that's right. It's all a ball game. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. We'll move on to other topics. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. John Faso, Fred Hoff, Judy Patrick, Mike Spain with us. We enjoy your comments as well. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Quick fact check, Ashley Biden was the speaker last night, and Joe and Jill's daughter. So that is what we were talking about. I thought the writer had said Clinton's daughter, which is what I got confused about. So we're better now. Peggy writes to us and says, I watched through to the end and was very proud to watch and hear President Biden. Not to bed until 1 a.m., and he deserved my time. Proud night. It was Biden's daughter. There we go. Then we go to this from David. What the heck does the country is moving in the wrong direction even mean? My impression is Republicans would say that if a Democrat is in office and vice versa. So it's a low information question. The continent is obviously not drifting at any perceptible speed.
That's a classic question that's asked just to get the tenor of the mood of the country. And you see it, it's a pretty good predictor. So the biggest impediment that Democrats will have in this election is that factor, the sense that, hey, things are off kilter, they're going in the wrong direction. And that's what Republicans will try to take advantage of. And this is a standard thing in any campaign. You're always looking at what's the overall mood of the electorate. And this is one that pollsters on either side will always go to right at the outset because it helps set the table for what a campaign is going to look at. So the biggest thing that Kamala Harris is going to have to do now, even though she's been part of the administration for 3.5 years, is disassociate herself from much of what has gone on in the Biden administration for the last 3.5 years. And that's what she's trying to do by saying, I'm the future, but she doesn't want to obviously talk about the past.
But it's also a variation of, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?
Correct. It's very much the same thing.
Yeah.
Sure. And even some of the speakers last night hinted at this. Gina Raimondo, one of the early speakers, Secretary of Commerce, former governor of Rhode Island, talked about the real hardships Americans are facing when they go to the grocery store. So it seems as though the Kamala Harris Democratic Party is taking the first step of avoiding denial on these issues, saying, yes, there are problems out there. Grocery prices across the board, according to the Wall Street Journal, up 29% since 2019. I mean, this is a real problem. Housing prices. And I don't know that the vice president is going to be able to disassociate herself really from the policies of the administration of which she's been a key part, but she can certainly emphasize that she hears the complaints that are out there.
I feel your pain.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, kind of
sure.
Like that.
But it's not a bad first step. Instead of just saying, oh, you know, the 65% of Americans who think we're headed in the wrong direction, well, they're just wrong. You know, they're just wrong. They need to do more reading. They need to look at the statistics. If that's the attitude, that's the surest way to lose this election.
Right. And that's what we heard from the Democrats from 6 months ago is, the unemployment's down. They would rattle off these
data
and overlook the fact that people were paying more at the grocery store and that rent was going up and people were having a hard time buying a house.
You will not hear the term, I support Bidenomics, and it's working. That's what Kamala Harris was saying 6 months ago, but that will not be what she's saying in the next few months.
I think the word itself has been just about abolished.
It's gone down the memory hole.
Yeah. I mean, she's trying to have it. She will try to have it both ways, John. She will try to celebrate what successes and what obvious successes there's been with Biden and disassociate herself from the negatives and the where he hasn't been successful.
Elaine says, what a show last night. Tears watching Hillary, fired up watching AOC, and finally tired and with a great smile on my face, feeling after many months of anguish, ultimately hope. I will say my favorite line, I think, of the night was from Hillary Clinton, who said, we have him on the run, which I thought
that fired up the audience.
Yeah, fired up the audience. And she followed that up by saying, the future is here. On the other side of that glass ceiling is Kamala Harris raising her hand and taking the oath of office. When a barrier falls from one of us, it falls and clears the way for all of us.
You know, as Stephen Colbert noted in the Late Show last night, he expressed surprise of the image of Donald Trump actually running. He didn't think he could actually physically run.
Run. Joanne says, John Faso's comment that Sean Fain and by association the UAW is pro-Hamas is totally out of line and a lie. He's listening to Trump too much. Please educate Mr. Faso to the fact that being pro-Palestinian is not the same as being pro-Hamas. I don't feel I'm qualified to educate John on anything.
That was you speaking, Joe?
Yes.
Well, I think, frankly, the listener is misreading the facts. I mean, the UAW has a large contingent of their workers who are organized in higher education, and they are virulently anti-Israel and pro-Hamas in this, and that's why the UAW's position is such, and that's why I've noted that Sean Fain had some discretion last night in choosing not to mention that.
Let's see. We go to Carol. Why no mention of the brave speeches by the women affected by abortion bans? We did mention that. I was praising those speeches, actually. The women who suffered sexual abuse from her stepfather was great, but I forgot you guys went to bed. No, I saw that. It was earlier.
Yeah.
It was earlier, yeah. And it was very moving. I was I was talking about the overall presentations, and I thought that was very, very effective in and very moving and important. We also go to Rebecca. I have to say that after last night, I was riding high this morning for sure, and listening to you just completely deflated all that. Did you all watch the same thing that I did? Maybe some speeches went along okay, but I watched it from beginning to end, and it's exactly what this party needed. That from Rebecca.
I'm worried that it went so long that it's going to suppress the momentum that the Democrats have going. I just think that short and sweet and to the point. I mean, when we used to edit stories, you edit them down because you don't want to burden your reader with a 25-inch story because it's an imposition. Short and sweet and to the point. Keep the momentum going with a little bit of speed.
Brevity is a virtue.
So do they bring James Taylor back, or do you think he's now in Stockbridge? Did they let him go, or they bring him
will
back?
Will he sing the 6-minute and 30-second version of You've Got a Friend, or the 2-minute version that was on the air?
We all have a friend by... Well. Stacey says, I thought the convention was fabulous. I thought the speeches were brief and inspiring, and I know, as an event organizer myself, that you can't always anticipate things like applause and chants, so it went an hour longer than you expected. Big deal. It was absolutely remarkable effort to put such a moving mass special event together in 2 weeks' time. Kudos to the organizers. Stacey, that is a great point. That is a really great point. This was a very different event than anyone had planned. Someone said earlier about the speech that Biden gave was very similar, perhaps, to his acceptance speech that he would have given on Thursday night. But four weeks and 2 days ago, we were not here. And
they had to change a lot of signs.
They got a lot of signs, a lot of bringing people in, moving things around. And that's a really excellent point.
It is. We'll see tonight and the next two nights whether or not they constrict the speaking schedule so that they're more on. I don't think they're going to put Kamala Harris on at 11:30 at night on Thursday. If they do, that's a big mistake.
I'd like to listen to the roundtable Friday if that happens.
Yeah, and it's usually a lighter load on Friday, too, because it's all leading up to that speech where it's usually done pretty early. But we'll see what happens. Stacey's...
Excuse me, Joe, if I could just interject something on the UAW issue, because this was something I'm not at all familiar with. Apparently, the UAW issued a statement on December 1st of last year calling officially for a ceasefire in Israel and Palestine. And then it goes on to say, in addition, the executive board voted to form a divestment and just transition working group to study the history of Israel and Palestine, the Union's economic ties to the conflict, and to explore how to achieve a just transition for U.S. workers from war to peace. I think this, you know, this falls well short of a total endorsement of Israel, which some people would obviously prefer. But I think it also falls well short of an endorsement of Hamas.
That's the direction they're going, though, I would suggest. And their their movement in terms of BDS is directly aimed at the state of Israel and their right to exist. And this is one of the problems that the Democrats have. They have a significant base in their party that is anti-Israel. A lot of some of those folks are anti-Semitic as well, and you see it from whether it's Occupy Wall Street, the influence of the Democratic Socialists of America, Black Lives Matter, all of these groups, this whole intersectionality of how we view people, and we view people as colonizers or oppressors, the oppressed versus the oppressors. This is a significant segment in the modern day Democratic Party. And that is why Kamala Harris has got to be really careful politically, because she's worried about losing Michigan. And that's what a lot of this is all about.
John Faso, Judy Patrick, Mike Spain, and Ambassador Fred Hoff. We will continue our conversation on the other side of a news break. We welcome your thoughts, your input, panel@wamc.org. First News with Ray Graff. A lot of talk about protests before the convention, and there were protests yesterday, outraged over Gaza. Protesters show left-wing divisions as convention opens. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Judy Patrick, John Faso, Mike Spain, and Ambassador Fred Hoff. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. A protest in Chicago on Monday, which was expected to be one of the largest of the week, drew fewer demonstrators than organizers had hoped for. And as Democrats gathered in Chicago, eager to project an image of a liberal movement fully united behind Vice President Kamala Harris, thousands of people marched a few blocks away, preventing a thorny counterpoint. For hours, protesters furious over the Biden administration's support for Israel and its failure to end the war in Gaza held signs, chanted, and pushed for Ms. Harris to break with the president on those issues. The loudest challenge to the opening day of the Democratic National Convention was coming not from Republicans, but from the progressive left. "It is no longer good enough just to stand against Trump," said Ellie McCool, who traveled from Minnesota to attend the march and had yet decided whether she would support Ms. Harris or some other candidate. "You have to do good." That from the New York Times. John, I don't have to start with you.
Well, I think that obviously, as I mentioned, there's a division. It's a faction. I'm not saying it's by any means a majority, but there's a faction in the Democratic Party. But particularly where it's going to be important is in the state of Michigan, and how this potentially very close election is going to be decided. And this is going to be a delicate dance for Vice President Harris to move forward on. It's going to be interesting to watch how this evolves. And they also have a closely contested U.S. Senate race in Michigan where this is going to be a big issue. So it just bears watching, and it'd be very interesting how the vice president addresses this issue, not just in her acceptance speech on Thursday night, but in whatever subsequent interviews that she does when she's actually asked tough questions about this issue and where she stands.
Fred Hoff.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would not expect the vice president to disassociate herself from the Biden administration's policy toward this conflict between Israel and Hamas. what she will do, just as she is doing with the economy, is she'll choose to emphasize certain things, her support for a ceasefire, her feelings of empathy toward toward Palestinian civilians who have been subjected to unspeakable hardships, but she won't forget about what happened on October 7th either. There is a faction within the Democratic Party and in Michigan. It's a particularly significant faction. I believe in the primary, there was something like 100,000 votes cast for no preference in the Democratic primary, and that's a if my memory is correct, that's a number larger than President Biden's winning
plurality
and margin in 2020. There have been progressives who have said, well, you know, we don't like either candidate, so perhaps we'll vote for the Green Party candidate, Dr. Jill Stein. That could have an impact on the final result. A lot depends on whether the administration's diplomacy seeking the ceasefire actually succeeds. As I've said before on this program, my only real source of optimism is that we have the best possible person, CIA Director William Burns, heading the American effort to get the ceasefire. Bill Burns is somebody I've known and admired for the better part of 40 years, and we can't do better than to have this superb American heading this effort. But you know, the United States finds itself in the same position it's found itself down through the decades in the Middle East, and that is that we want something to happen much more than the pertinent parties want. Both Israel, particularly the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and Hamas, and Hamas's major backer, Iran, everybody has real reservations about entering into a ceasefire in Gaza. They have their own reasons, but in a way, they're presenting a bit of a united front, obstructing American efforts. Now, the latest news is that Israel, according to our Secretary of State, has agreed to a the latest compromise American proposal. Hamas is taking the position that no, this reflects Israeli desires. We're not going to move, but we'll see. I mean, ideally, this week or soon after, there will be a ceasefire agreement, and that's when the hard work will really begin.
Fred, one of the things that that apparently is a holdup is the Philadelphia corridor.
Yeah,
and that is, of course, the boundary between Gaza and Egypt. Israel, I think, rightly is saying that they do not want to relinquish control of that corridor because that's the way the Hamas has been able to build tunnels and infiltrate weapons and supplies into Gaza. How do you think that issue plays out?
Secretary of State Tony Blinken has said that Israel, number one, he said that Israel has agreed to an American bridging proposal. He didn't specifically mention the Philadelphia corridor, but as you note, it's one of the key outstanding issues. And immediately after making that statement in Israel, Blinken flew to Egypt to meet with the Egyptian president, Sisi, at Sisi's summer resort. So I presume that there is some kind of formula being worked on that may involve Egyptian forces manning all or part of the Philadelphia corridor, perhaps in conjunction with Israeli forces. I don't know. I have no, you know, truth in advertising. I have no inside knowledge of what's being proposed here. But it's just the timing and the logistics of the diplomacy we can all see that suggests the United States is trying to pull Egypt into playing some kind of a role here, something that that the Egyptians to date have been very reluctant to do.
Yeah, I know. I just wonder, from a domestic political point of view, if there is a ceasefire, however fragile it may be, it seems to me if that would hold through election, that would sort of put that issue a little bit down on the agenda, and it would benefit.
I would think so. If you don't have large numbers of Palestinian civilians, being killed, displaced, et cetera, then that alone should, I think, cause the issue itself to be regarded a bit calmer in domestic American politics.
Judy?
Yeah, I know the Democratic Party wants to have a display of unity, and they are upset that protesters are outside their convention in Chicago. But protesting, voicing different opinions, is a important part of America's tradition of free speech. And they are at the Democratic convention in Chicago, and they weren't really at the Republican convention, in large part because the Democrats control the White House at this point, and that's why they're there. I think political protest, political speech is appropriate, needs to be acknowledged, and not demeaned, because I'm hearing Democrats inside the convention hall being upset with the protesters detracting from the unified look that the Harris campaign wants.
Judy, you're right. Protest is something we protect in this country, but another issue that's going to arise for the Democrats is whether the campus protests and encampments start once the school year begins in September. And that will be a negative for Democrats, again, highlighting the difference, the division within their party over the Israel-Gaza war.
What do you think? Do you think they will start in earnest?
I think any college president that permits an encampment on their grounds is making a gigantic mistake. And I think that once you open the door to that, getting rid of it is going to be much more difficult.
You know, we had an encampment at Bard. It was rather low key. The students who ran the encampment, for the most part, behaved properly. I think the key difference at Bard was that the president of the college, Leon Botstein, got directly involved in things. He was willing to get a little dirt under his fingernails and come out, speak with the students, convey a sense of respect. When they asked him, "Well, are you a Zionist?" He said, "Yes. Yes, I am." I mean, there's no question about this. But leadership, whether it's on college campuses or any place, really involves people in charge, getting deeply enmeshed in the situation. We had a situation at Columbia, where the now departed president of the university was asked by the faculty senate, "Have you been out to visit the encampment? Have you visited with the students there?" And her response was, "I haven't been invited." What kind of leadership is that? I mean, she's the mayor.
No surprise.
She's the mayor of Columbia University. Yeah.
And you would think, I mean, I don't, not to belabor this, but it seems as if something that major is going on campus, that the president of the college and university and or university would as you said, get a little dirt under their
fingernails. Get out behind your desk and get out. Talk to the students. I would suspect if we do have a ceasefire in place, say by Labor Day, there will probably be not much in the way of campus encampments.
What do you think the chances of that are, given what we're hearing from Blinken, given what we're hearing from Israel and Hamas for that part?
I don't know that I could put a percentage on it. Right now the Israeli Knesset, the Israeli Parliament, is in recess. Okay, if Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu really really wants the ceasefire, this is his opportunity to get it, because the ability of coalition partners, his partners, who have threatened to bring down the government, their ability to do so during a Knesset recess is limited. But there's a major question on the Hamas side also. Does the new leader, Yahya Sinwar, the author of the atrocities that took place on October 7th, does he want a ceasefire? Does Iran really want a ceasefire?
Let me ask you a question that I asked you several months ago, and I think it's pertinent now, in that so you know this guy, you know Netanyahu, you've been in a room negotiating with him,
sure,
and face to face in negotiating, which unless John has been holding out on me, I believe you're the only one in the room who has done that.
I've met him. I haven't negotiated.
Okay, there you go. Okay, so I'm right in my premise. All right.
I haven't met him.
Nor have I. Yeah. I know. I had BBs as a kid. That's about as close as I've come. Anyway, what I'm curious about is, immediately following October 7th, we kept on hearing that this was a— He wasn't long for this world politically. This was going to be a very quick, very decisive. So where are we all these months later, coming into almost a year of his strength, of his power, and the power that he has to negotiate something that is viable?
Look, I think a majority, a strong majority of Israelis want an end to Bibi Netanyahu's premiership in the country, but this guy is just a master political tactician. I think at the end of the day, he can see some benefit in keeping the conflict going, because people are understandably reluctant to switch horses in midstream. At the same time, he is under an enormous amount of pressure to get the living hostages back to Israel. I had an Israeli friend who who knew Netanyahu quite well, and I remarked to this guy once, I said, Bibi is the living embodiment of the person who measures twice before cutting. He is an incredibly cautious, calculating person. And my friend said, Fred, you got it all wrong. He'll measure 500 times before cutting. So he is giving this some serious thought now, especially with the Knesset on recess. Can I afford politically to make a deal that at least in the near term leaves Hamas alive and breathing in the Gaza Strip? And this is I know he's giving this a lot of thought.
Well, this is why Philadelphia is so significant, because he could come to an agreement, I think, but if it meant Hamas has ability to traffic arms and material through the Philadelphia corridor again, he will. I don't believe
he will. Yeah, I think that's the minimum he's got to get. He's got to be able to tell the Israeli people that, yes, even though some of these folks are still living and breathing, the security threat to the state of Israel has been diminished significantly as a result of IDF Israeli military operations over the past 10 months. He has to be able to tell Israelis that. And, you know, the other issue has to do with a residual Israeli military presence that would monitor the movement of civilians back to their homes in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, you know, trying to ensure that there are not armed men moving with them.
This Knesset recess is a long one, right? It's more
than
one.
I think it goes until late October.
Yeah. As far as Blinken's work and here, I think throughout this process he has been praised at various times. Do you think that's still warranted?
Yeah, I mean, look, Blinken is doing his best, but again, the key person in terms of the actual American mediation is the CIA director, Bill Burns. What struck me, I mean, you know, when I was a kid, you know, if the Secretary of State was doing an overseas trip, this was big news. You know, if John Foster Dulles or Dean Rusk was going over, this was big news. Now, the Secretary of State is running up airline miles.
It's like an Uber ride.
Yeah, it's like he's a State Department.
He's an envoy.
State Department desk officer. He's on the move. He's on the move constantly, and I've lost track of how many times he's been in the Middle East, particularly in Israel. So he's definitely making the effort.
Let's go to a couple of letters from listeners. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we will take a break in just a moment and then come back and finish up with the last part of the program. I've always supported Israel's right to exist and still do, writes Leslie. However, I now question that position. It seems here in the U.S., the needs of the Palestinians is completely disregarded. How is it Israel and its radical settlers have the right to rob Palestinians of their land?
Sorry.
No, that's okay. I just thought there was ice cream coming. What other populations would willingly give up their homeland to another?
Well, the writer has a point. Something that's often overlooked because of the scale of because of what happened on October 7th, because of the scale of destruction in the Gaza Strip, is what's going on in the West Bank. With Israeli settlers running amok, sometimes with the support of cabinet members, and only recently has the Prime Minister been pushing back on this publicly.
The next letter I'm going to read, the last letter before we go to a break, is mean. But I have to give it a certain amount of credit for it being amusing. So I'm going to read it, but I just want you to know I do not endorse it in any way, shape, or form. Dear panel, this conversation among semi-retired elders is getting to be too much of a Cracker Barrel session. Count John Faso is the village atheist in this group. He insists our entire society, with all its qualities, is on shaky ground financially and otherwise. I believe him. We need the Democrats to look deeply into how they can or can't do what they'd like to do. Otherwise, Trump or Harris will be ruled by fools. And that is from George in Texas. And there you go. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. We'll be right back. We have been spending much of the program talking about what is going on in Chicago and with the Democrats. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, the former president of the United States is continuing to hold rallies and to campaign throughout the country. Donald Trump on Monday questioned whether Democrats knew where Vice President Kamala Harris, quote, came from. This is a reprise of a tactic that he has previously used against other Democrats, including former President Barack Obama and women of color in Congress. Trump also freshly described Harris's policy positions as a regulatory jihad without explanation, using a loaded Arabic term often translated as holy war. He consistently mispronounced her first name, which her supporters see as demeaning and racist towards Harris, a black and Indian American woman. At another point, he questioned her upbringing. I wonder if they knew where she comes from, where she came from, what her ideology is, referencing Harris's father, a distinguished Jamaican economist. Harris has said that she was raised primarily by her mother. Trump has misleadingly called Donald Harris Marxist, though this oversimplifies a long career as an academic focused on international deployment and practical questions related to the economy of his home nation. Trump made the remarks as part of complaining that Democrats replaced President Joe Biden with Harris on their presidential ticket. In his comments, Trump echoed his 2019 barb against several Democratic congresswomen of color, Representatives Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib, telling them to go back to where they came from. That comment was widely condemned at the time as racist and xenophobic. I would add it probably has not aged well either. But
what do you do with this? From a media perspective, when you have this amount of reprehensible expression of racism, xenophobia, do you continue to report on it? Do you try to find nuggets of sanity in the mishmash of what he gives as a speech? I mean, it continues to be a real challenge for the media and how to properly cover Donald Trump. Do we try to find nuggets of real policy buried in these speeches? Or do we highlight the fact that he's saying these outrageous things that are clearly racist, that are clearly sexist, that are clearly personal attacks? Is this what we've become? Going back just briefly to the Democratic Convention, it was refreshing to see people give speeches where you heard a whole sentence at once, and they were clear, they were well thought out. I mean, we go back to the Donald Trump speeches. I mean, is it valuable for America to hear all of these things, or should we suppress it?
John?
Well, I think these comments are not effective. They're obviously incendiary. They're often over the line in many respects. And the bottom line, if Donald Trump wants to win the election, he'll win the election in swing states with swing voters who aren't going to be persuaded by this line of attack. Anytime he's not talking about inflation, immigration, the economy, national defense is a wasted moment for him politically. And not that he would take my political advice, but Kamala Harris, I mean, she's imitated one of his worst recommendations, which is to end taxation of tips. It makes no sense from an economic or a tax revenue standpoint. And Harris, her proposals the other day are border on economic illiteracy about having the federal government regulate prices. Hadn't she ever heard about Nixon's price controls and what an abominable failure they were? And the price controls of back to ancient times, that they don't work. No reputable economist is going to say that these proposals make any sense whatsoever. He should be attacking those things and reminding people that Kamala Harris has been there for 3.5 years when people, as Fred had noted before, 60-something percent of the public doesn't like the direction of the country. He should make her aware of those policies. But instead, he diverts. And this is Donald Trump. There's no discipline on the campaign trail, and he's not focused on the things that are going to get him success in November.
Mike.
Maybe back to Judy's, the dilemma that the media has in covering Trump and how to portray it. I don't think it's the media's responsibility to go through an hour-long speech that rambles on to try to pull out something that might be policy and portray it as Trump policy. I think it is important for the full context of his speeches to be reported. I mean, he has used the name Hannibal Lecter, the fictional character who was a cannibal, 20 times in speeches in the last several months. He uses it to scare people and suggest that the immigrants coming in over the southern border are, you know, in 2016, he said they were murderers and rapists. Now they're going to eat you, I guess, is what he's trying to say. I mean, some of the stuff that he says is just bizarre. It's crazy. We focused, the media focused on Biden and some of the disjointed things he was saying during his campaigning, and certainly it was exhibited during the June 27th debate that he botched so badly. But they need to tell the public the incongruent things that Trump is saying so that they can understand that something is missing there. If he's unable, John, to discipline himself and talk about what's wrong with Kamala Harris's positions and what has failed in the Biden administration, if he can't articulate that, if he can just attack people because of where they're from or by their name or you know, it was effective with Obama. When he said Obama was not born in the U.S., there were surveys that showed something like 35% of Americans, or at least Republicans, believe that Obama was not a legitimate American citizen and therefore not a legitimate president. I mean, this kind of race baiting, unfortunately, is effective, and it should be put in context. And I think the stories like this Washington Post story that we're talking about today are appropriate journalism to call out this kind of rhetoric.
You know, I think that if for 75 days, Donald Trump could mimic gentlemanly behavior, he would not lose a single vote from his base. But what he could do is pick up some people among a small but very decisive portion of the electorate that is still open to voting either way. I know there are Republicans who are expressing hope that the return of Corey Lewandowski to the campaign will add a voice, perhaps an important voice, someone who can sit down with the former president and say, hey, you want to lose this election, just rely on your own instincts, say what you want to say, and you'll blow it. You'll blow it not only for yourself, you'll blow it for the Republican Party. He really needs to be focused. He may be personally incapable of doing it, but having a professional next to him all the time saying, "Hey, pal, come on, don't screw this up." This I think is going to be important. The name Donald Trump, I'm told, I think I read in a paper this morning, was mentioned 151 times last night at the Democratic convention, not in a favorable context. For people who are interested in in the quality, the actual quality of the Trump bashing that took place last night, I would urge them to read today's edition of the Washington Post Fact Checker. Okay. again, for people who are interested in the actual truth of the matter. And they'll, they'll see that, Mr. Trump is not alone in misrepresenting the views of others.
Anybody else on that? You've silenced the group, Fred. Congratulations.
Well, I think that I've been with many of my former colleagues on the Republican side and others that I still talk to. waiting for Trump to become disciplined is like waiting for Godot. I'm not sure we're ever going to find that.
Right. But that must be, Fred was alluding to
it. It's frustrating as hell.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the fact is there's an Kamala Harris, her policies are an ample target of opportunity for Republicans. But if Donald Trump is unable to seize that opportunity, he will surely forfeit the pivotal electoral college states that are going to decide this election. Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, all of them, frankly, Democrats I know are on a high now. They should realize that eventually the worm will turn and just the pendulum of politics. This is going to be a very competitive race right down to the end. And there's a lot of opportunities for Republicans to take advantage of Harris's positions, the Biden administration record, et cetera. But as my three colleagues have said, if Trump persists in going down these paths that are, deemed to be racist or xenophobic or whatever, he is not going to win.
Are and not deemed to be. They are racist, xenophobic.
No. Okay. So, but he will not win. And whether he can heed the advice of aides and others, I think, is very much up in the air.
I think you make a really good point. I think the Democrats are on a high, and they've been looking at the Siena New York Times polls and the other polls, especially in swing states. You know, North Carolina's in play now, all these things. And it's very, very close, and it could go either way, and the margin of error has it very, very tight. It's a very tight election.
With that, we are very tight on time and need to end for this segment. I thank you all for being with us. Judy Patrick, John Faso, Mike Spain, and Fred Hoff, I thank you all for being here. A wonderful program as always. We'll be right back with Congressional Corner after this.